So it is Halloween week, and it feels like it's like the best time to do spooky Dharma, right? And we don't have like tons of spooky stories. There are sometimes like ghostish stories in the suttas and the scriptures, but it is going to be a night of storytelling. But we do have a couple of characters that definitely fall in like kind of the territory, at least in part of their lives, of what might characterize, you know, a horror film. And I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Angulimala. Anybody heard of Angulimala? My favorite serial killer. And he is not officially the patron saint of former robbers, criminals, and murderers, but those of us who are former things like that definitely have adopted him as our patron saint, though he's technically the patron saint of women in pregnancy and childbirth. But we're going to tell his story tonight. So this comes. Some of it comes from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses of the Buddha. Some of it comes from the commentaries, and some of it comes from the way stories get told through time, right? So some of it's like cultural artifact. So we don't actually begin with the story of anybody named Angulimala. We begin with somebody who gets the name Ahimsaka. And this person lived at the time of the Buddha. And his story actually begins with his birth. And it begins in kind of a way similar to the story of the Buddha's life. It begins with a horoscope or a prophecy. And so there were a couple of folks that actually were in the court of a king, King Pasenadi, and they were getting ready to have a child. And when the child was born, they had a horoscope, and the horoscope said that the child would become a robber. The child was born under what they call the robber's constellation. And of course, like technically this means the person was going to be a loner, criminal, possibly a murderer, all sorts of things that, you know, parents would never want their child to become. Just like the Buddha's parents didn't want him to become a holy man. This child's parents didn't want him to become a robber or a criminal. Now, I don't know how many folks in here, believe in horoscopes in that particular way, if they believe in astrology in that particular way, whether there's like an actual constellation in the sky, an arrangement of the stars that predetermines one towards a life of crime or anything like that. But we could interpret, if we choose, to be that there are causes and conditions that we are born into that may predispose us for particular things, you know. Not necessarily always good things. We may be predisposed for drug addiction. We may be predisposed for certain educational outcomes. And it's not anything about the person who's being born, but the conditions they're born into. And perhaps that's the constellation that this child was born into. Either way, the parents decided that we don't want this kid to become a criminal. And so they named him Ahimsaka, almost as a way of naming the child as an ideal. And if you're familiar with the word ahimsa, which means non-harming or non-violence, so ahimsaka means harmless one. And so they named this youngster Ahimsaka. And he was, by every stretch of the imagination, a good kid. You know, he excelled in school. He excelled in, I don't know if you want to call it sports, but the tales are that he was highly athletic and that he could wrestle a bull, like, all the things you could attach to the kid being like excellent at, he had it. And he impressed his teachers. And at some point he was, they say he was in school, but it sounds like he was also studying with like a guru of some sort, like a spiritual teacher. And that he wasn't the only one studying with this guru. That he impressed this guru. Like he was the star pupil. And as we sometimes, maybe we were the star pupils ourselves, or maybe we were in the classrooms with star pupils. I'm not sure. But maybe some resentment on the part of the other kids in the class, the other pupils. And so there came to be a point where the other kids, if you will, young adults that were studying beneath this teacher, grew jealous of Ahimsaka. And they planted seeds of doubt in the teacher. Tried to convince the teacher that either Ahimsaka was trying to take his spot. Some of the rumors were potentially that Ahimsaka and the teacher's wife may have had a thing going on. There's different tales going on here, but they were planting lots of seeds. And eventually the teacher came to distrust his students, his star students, Ahimsika. These are all the, also the conditions that we're born into. These are also conditions that are out of our control. Maybe this is part of the robber constellation. I don't know. But what did end up happening is the teacher came to distrust Ahimsika enough that he wanted to figure out a way to get rid of him. And the way that he decided to get rid of him was to ask an impossible task of him and hope that the task was so ridiculous that he would just decide to go away. And so the task he asked of him of Ahimsika was that for his, we'll call it final certification, but for like full corroboration of his learning, he was to go and collect the right pinky fingers of 1,000 people. And now normally, someone would go like, "No, I'm sorry, dude. I don't need the degree that much," right? But that's not what happened here. Ahimsika wanted to please his teacher enough and wanted this recognition enough that he set out to go collect 1,000 fingers. And so he terrorized the countryside. He robbed people. He robbed people one at a time, two at a time, 10 at a time, 40 at a time. He killed them and he collected their fingers. And in the beginning, he would collect the fingers, but I don't know, like the commentaries are kind of funny. At some point, he decided that it would be better to organize them by stringing them. So he started to weave all of these pinky fingers into a necklace that he then wore around his neck. And this is how he came to be known as Angulimala. Mala, we all know what a mala is, right? Like the little kind of the beads. You can wear them around your neck. You can wear, some people wear them around their wrist. They use them for prayer or mantra recitation. So nobody knew that Ahimsika and Angulimala were the same person, probably because he was really good at taking victims. What people did know is that there was somebody in the countryside that it was dangerous out in the forest, and that this person was collecting the fingers of the people whose lives he took. And he wore them around his neck. Now, Angulimala eventually found himself having collected 999 pinky fingers. One more finger. That's all he needed, right? Now, it's around this time that that his mother, Ahimsika's mother, Angulimala's mother, it's like finally has put two and two together, realizes that her son hasn't been at school in a while, and there's this wildness happening out in the countryside, and she realizes that her son, Ahimsika, is in fact Angulimala. So she sets out to go find him. I know what it was like to have mothers come after me to try to save me when I was out running amok. And at the same time, King Pasenadi, the villagers are complaining to him. They're terrified of this robber, this killer. And so he puts together an army to go out and search of Angulimala. So mom is after him. The police are after him. That's what the army is, right? Now the Buddha is in the neighborhood. He's with the Sangha. He's in the neighborhood. And he realizes that Angulimala is nearby. He sees within Angulimala, despite everything he's done, he sees with him the conditions for awakening. Like he can see into his heart. And he sees the conditions for awakening. He sees the potential for full awakening, and recognizes that his mother is on his way, her way to the forest, and that if he kills her, he will lose those conditions. And so the Buddha says, "Well, I better go out and have a talk with Angulimala." And so the story is that Angulimala sees his mother in the forest and realizes that she is the 1,000th finger, and sets after her to kill her. And then the Buddha steps in between him and his mother. And Angulimala sees the Buddha and says, "Well, okay, here's a monk, probably an easier target." And so chases after the Buddha. At which point the Buddha performs kind of a feat, maybe it's magic, I don't know. But no matter how fast Angulimala ran after the Buddha, he could not catch up with him. And the Buddha was just doing, like, I just imagine like a Thich Nhat Hanh slow walk. He's just chill. He's walking slowly, and Angulimala cannot catch up to him. And so Angulimala yells, "Stop, recluse, stop, recluse." And the Buddha turns to him and says, I have stopped Angulimala. You've stopped too. And this is a confusing moment for Angulimala, right? Because he's thinking, he's like, hold on a second. The Buddha's the one walking. I've stopped. He's telling me I'm not stopped, but that he stopped. And I like to think of this almost as like an early version of a koan, right? To the Buddha, it makes perfect sense. To Angulimala, it disrupts his train of thought. It disrupts kind of like the cascading thoughts that are leading him to this moment where he's going to cause harm. There's some type of disruption. Angulimala says, "While you are walking, recluse, you tell me you have stopped. But now, when I have stopped, you say I have not stopped. I ask you now about the meaning. How is it that you have stopped and I have not?" And so he is asking the Buddha for a teaching. Angulimala, he's out here, he's going to kill this monk. He's asking him for a teaching, and then realizes that it's actually the Blessed One. He then realizes that it's actually the Buddha and not just a random monk. Because then he says, "Oh, at long last, this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake." And that's the one that hits me every time I read it. Because this is when Angulimala realizes, despite what he'd been doing, that the Buddha came to him for his sake and no one else. And I feel like that's the second disruption. The Buddha like did two very important things here. He disrupted this chain of thought with the koan, and he disrupted the cycle of hatred and anger and ill will with compassion. And Angulimala felt both of those. Having heard your stanza in the teaching, having heard your stanza on the teaching of the Dhamma, I will indeed renounce evil forever. I'm sorry, I skipped a phrase here. The Buddha says to Angulimala, "I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence towards living beings, but you have no restraint towards things that live. This is why I have stopped and you have not." And then Angulimala renounces evil forever. So the bandit took his sword and he took his weapons and he flung them in a gaping chasm's pit and threw his weapons so they could not be retrieved anymore. He then asked for the going forth. And for those who aren't aware, going forth is essentially he became a monk, became a bhikkhu, but he took the precepts. We could think of it as the five precepts, but as we know with monks, it can be many and more. Though I'm not entirely sure at this point in the history whether the 300 plus rules for monastics were in existence then. But he certainly took the precepts for non-harming, non-stealing, no sexual misconduct, wise speech, and non-intoxication, something along those lines, and everything that follows. So Angulimala becomes a monk. He lives with the Sangha, but the king is still after him with the cops. The police are still coming. And they do eventually show up to the forest where the Buddha and the Sangha are staying. And the king actually shows up to warn the Buddha, like, "Hey, there's this dangerous character in the forest. I want to let you know about him." And the Buddha basically looks at the king and said, What if this terrible robber and this terrible murderer had actually put down his weapons, taken up the holy life, and was living on the requisites, right? Living on the alms of others." And the king says, "Well, if that person did in fact do that, then I would provide the requisites. I would provide the alms myself." And so the Buddha kind of does this thing. He holds his arm out. And I like to imagine it's a tree nearby. I don't know. That's the way the image is in my head. But I like to imagine a tree nearby, and below it sits Angulimala and says, "Great king, this is Angulimala." And at first, the king feels a significant amount of fear, but then goes and questions him, asks him if he is in fact this Angulimala, formerly Ahimsaka, confirms it is, blesses him, offers him alms, which Angulimala actually turns down because he had chosen to take greater precepts than the rest of the Sangha. So the king leaves. We never, by the way, hear anything about his mother. The mom wandered around, I guess, never found him. So he's living with the Sangha now, which means he lives off of the alms of others, right? And despite the fact that he's started over, despite the fact that he's taken up this new life, despite the fact that he's not harming people anymore, the people in the village know who he is, or they know who he was. So he has a hard time actually putting food in his alms bowl. He walks around to the villages, and people resent him for what he'd done in the past. And on one of these alms rounds, he walks past a pregnant woman, a woman in childbirth, and has this great uprising of compassion for the suffering that she appears to be in. How great is the suffering of the world, he says to himself. How great is the suffering of being? And the commentaries tell us that this is the first thought of compassion that had ever arisen in his life, the first time. And so Angulimala returns to the Buddha and tells him about the pregnant woman that he saw. And the Buddha says, go back to her and offer a blessing. Offer a blessing to her and say, sister, since I was born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well, and may your infant be well. And Angulimala says, no, venerable sir, wouldn't I be telling a deliberate lie? For I had intentionally deprived many living beings of life. And what's going on here is Angulimala still identifies with the person he was before he took the precepts. He's still identifying with the self that existed as Angulimala, the one that took life, the one that caused harm, the one that was robbing people. And so you could argue to a certain extent, like Angulimala's inability to offer this blessing worded this way is a reflection of the deep shame and remorse that he had. In fact, the commentaries say that at this point in time, Angulimala could not take up a meditation object. That when he would go out to the forest to meditate, that the only thing that he saw in the forest when he meditated were the limbs of the people whose lives he took and the voices of them asking him to spare their life. That's how tormented Angulimala was by his past. And so the Buddha offers an alternative. It says, Angulimala, go and say to this woman, since I was born with noble birth, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well and may your infant be well. And so Angulimala does this. He says this prayer, this blessing to the pregnant woman, and she has a successful childbirth. The child is healthy. And what's important here is that there's healing in Angulimala's heart, because to a certain extent, the blessing was effective. But the blessing was effective at restoring him to a sense of this new life that he had taken up. It's at this point that he starts to let go of the old self that he had identification with. It restores his relationship in the community because they see the blessing that he offers and they see its results. And so at this point, Angulimala is now able to get food in his alms bowl, by the way, most of the time. And Angulimala is now able to take up a meditation object. He relinquishes his past identity. And just as the Buddha saw in his heart, when he was out in the forest looking for his 1,000th finger, Angulimala finds awakening. He finds Nibbana. He does what has to be done. Story's not over there. Story's not over there. He's now an arahant, right? He's an awakened being. He's come into the full embodiment of his original name. He's become Ahimsaka. He's become the name that his parents had bestowed upon him so many years earlier. Everybody said he was destined to become a robber, a criminal, and a murderer. But he goes on an alms round, and not everybody in the world is forgiven. Sure, many have, but not everybody. Doesn't matter, perhaps, what he did or what he could do in that lifetime that would restore those people's opinions of him. Doesn't matter how long it's been. This is a personal anecdote, but I still get called a felon, an addict, a criminal by people that pretty much don't know me. And it's, I just can't take this personally. So Angulimala goes out on alms round and he's beaten. And they throw rocks at him and they hit him with sticks and they tear his robe and they break his alms bowl. And he comes back. When he comes back to the Sangha, he's an awakened being. His physical body is experiencing this pain, but he remains with equanimity. He is unmoved. But the Buddha sees Angulimala bleeding. He sees his robes torn. He sees his broken bowl, and he says, bear it, Brahman, bear it. You're experiencing in the here and now what may have taken many lifetimes to work through. So as an awakened being, and this is where we start to get into like kind of like the theology, if you want to call it, of rebirth. An awakened being, of course, once they've achieved Nibbana, they're not coming back again. that round of rebirth has been extinguished. But they may not be subject to rebirth in a future life or many future lives, but they are still subject to some of the consequences of actions that have been performed in this life. In fact, a Buddha had a specific pain in his foot that was directly related to some of his karmic paths, but it was being worked out in this lifetime. And so the instruction from the Buddha here is to a certain extent rejoice in the ability to work through this karma here and now. And there's something very Tibetan Vajrayana about this teaching of seeing these people that are delivering the abuse at him, that are delivering violence at him. They consider them our teacher, his teacher. Not much more is said of Angulimala now at this point. This was kind of like the pivotal part of the story, is the fact that even after being awakened, he was abused by people in the world, but he did write a poem, and it's a good one. And so we're going to close with Angulimala's poem tonight. Who once did live in negligence, and then is negligent no more. He illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. Who checks the evil deeds he did by doing wholesome deeds instead. He illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. The youthful bhikkhu who devotes his efforts to the Buddha's teaching, he illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. Conduit makers guide the water. Fletchers straighten out the arrow shaft. Carpenters straighten out the timber. But wise men seek to tame themselves. There are some that tame with beatings. Some that tame with goads and whips. But I was tamed by such a one who had no rod nor any weapons. Harmless one is the name I bear. Though I was dangerous in the past, the name I bear today is true. I hurt no living being at all. And though I once lived as a bandit, known to all as Finger Garland, one whom the great flood of greed, hatred, and delusion swept along, I went for refuge to the Buddha. And though I once was bloody-handed with the name of Finger Garland, see the refuge I have found. The bond of being has been cut. While I did many deeds that lead to rebirth in evil realms, yet the result has reached me now. And so I eat, free from debt. And a little note about that last line, eating free from debt. Traditionally, when monks would go on their alms round and they're not yet awakened, or when the Dharma teacher or people within the Sangha ask for alms round, they receive those alms as an inheritance of the Buddha. The work and the teachings of the Buddha was so great and so impactful that any donation to him spreads to those in the Sangha. But once one is awakened, then one's alms are received with their own inheritance. And so when it says, I eat free from debt, it's essentially saying that I'm awakened now and I reap these benefits. May we all eat free from debt. And of course, per usual, open for sharing questions. And if you have a Kastaman and we don't know what it is, please let us know if you're sharing.
Matt, is that story, that entire story in the Majjhima-nikāya? Or is that,
Yeah.
Is that entire story in the Majjhima-nikāya, or is, have you included commentary?
So some of it, because you have the sutta, right? You also have the notes in the sutta, right? That lets you, you know, if you go to the back, that it'll tell you what the commentary says around those notes. And there's another book that's a useful resource. I think it's called The Great Disciples of the Buddha. It's like, it kind of looks, got the same cover as most of our Pali Canon books, but it's green. And it tells in narrative fashion the story of Angulimala using stuff from the commentaries and tradition and the sutta as well.
Thank you.
And there's also,
I've heard the story, you know, many, many, many times, never like that.
No? No.
Not to that detail.
Oh, I see.
No, just in general. What was the name of that book?
Great Disciples of the Buddha.
Thank you.
It's one of those books that it makes me cry when I read it. I don't know, like if there's something about like the tales of all of these different disciples having found awakening that is really touching sometimes for you to read it. One of those sorts of books.
Thank you. This is all the Bhikkhu Bodhis, like the great disciples of Buddha. It's also the Bhikkhu Bodhi.
I was just,
So if I look at Sutta Central and a few other sources, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, in addition to translating from Pali into Sutta, he refers to Chinese Agamas, which is the translation of the original text that were lost. And that's where he finds the commentary. And he says, in my translation, I took the liberty of including the commentary. That's not there, I'm just Sutta translations.
And yeah, if you go down the rabbit hole with notes and commentaries, you'll find little details like explanations about like supposedly when Ahimsaka was born, all of the weapons in the city glowed, right? They all glowed. And the king that night actually was awoken because the swords in his bedroom were glowing. Like that's how significant this robber constellation was when he was born. Very Halloweenish, right?
I'm so glad I made it to that. Thank you so much for your practice, Matt. I could feel this, the hope of maybe the first time you read that and felt like, okay, I can move through, or this can get better, whatever it was. Like I kind of felt that, and I wish I'd heard this talk like 25 years ago. Maybe I'd have been a little bit less, you know, kind of like tense around my own progress and my practice. And I would have had more of a feeling of both, and like that both the hope and of this contact with, you know, with the Buddha, that could even coexist with all of the constellation of the birth of this person and all that came with it. And for me, I feel a lot of epigenetic, like historical, like ancestral weight that kind of drags along with all of the cultural garbage that wants to put us all in our positions and keep us there, however we are. And this just kind of just lets it all be, and yet still there is awakening.
Despite it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm just like, this is just so encouraging. Encouraging isn't really the right word, but I just, knowing your history, the possibility that this would engender in one's practice, I can't even, I wish I'd heard it. Thank you.
Angulimala is very popular inside. But inside, sorry, maybe I say that too colloquially, inside of prison, jail. You know, I was leading a group in San Quentin, there's a man there who's part of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha Sunday night group in San Quentin. It's a Zen group, but that's the group he was a part of. And he had like this big necklace on. He was wearing this big, like homemade prison necklace. And it said Ahimsaka, you know, because it's like when I fantasize about getting knuckle pats, it's because Ahimsaka fits perfectly. Right, like we who have been in those places, like we really look up to this character, right? Like this story is really important to folks who've been places like that. It's very hopeful, provides a lot of hope. And that, you know, another thing, I feel like every time like I go through this story and I read the sutta again, you know, like new things stand out to me. This is how it is with the suttas in general. But like what struck me is that when I was reading it this time, and I guess I meant to say it tonight, but it just didn't pop in my brain when I was talking, is like the conditions that transformed Ahimsaka into Angulimala remain. You know, like the conditions where they're refusing to give him alms, the conditions of like breaking his bowl and hitting him with a stick and all of that stuff. Those are essentially the same conditions of the robber constellation in the first place, right? Like the conditions in the world did not change. The world remained, was on fire and remained on fire. And he found his awakening, right? So yes, we have these conditions that can spin us out a little bit, and there's a way.
Thank you for a great story. You know, you have just, for me, just shown one of the beauties of Buddhism and really a connecting link that all of the religions have. And whether you like, whether you buy into the, buy in is probably not the appropriate word, but whether you accept the dogma of Catholicism or the dogma of Judaism or Islam, if you can get over that and go to the foundational principles, it's really amazing how all of them have these stories that are metaphors for do no harm, fundamental believing that the individual, whether you take the Buddhist expression that there's a Buddha within all of us, even the orange monster, whether you see it in hundreds of different places, or you think that it's Jesus within you or Moses, it's amazing how these stories are just wonderful metaphors. And to an extent, all of the symbolism, all of the ways that we're supposed to practice are almost irrelevant, because this is the foundation of the things that are our humanity. And so that's what you, I mean, in Judaism, they take the Old Testament, and through thousands of years, we've got every rabbi of every race, of every shape, manner, and philosophy doing commentaries, and they call it the Midrash. And all the commentary, because Buddha, because we, that our fundamental is based on really the most basic oral tradition. How much of that came about in 1764, and how much of it came about in, you know, BCE? So not to decry it, it's just really beautiful what you've explained, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
So, whatever his name.
So when Gulimala gets the rocks thrown at him or bloodied, and the Buddha says, like, rejoice because you're able to exhaust this karma that you did during your lifetime when you were a murderer. I get like within one lifetime, he has the consequences of his actions. But when you talk like life to life, like for example, you gave an example like the Buddha with his foot problem that I'm assuming like was from like a karmic relation to a past life. Could you talk more about, like, I know karma is not like a cosmic justice system, but what is like getting exhausted in that sense?
So when this is where you can go, you can get lost in the weeds real fast here. But when this is hard sometimes for people to wrap their brain around, myself included, because I'm not awakened. But when a Buddha is awakened, when awakening happens, they can no longer create good or bad karma. The intentions no longer have impact in the world whatsoever for someone who's awakened, according to tradition, right? But past fruit can still bear, right? And I think the best example is like there are karmic consequences that happen like with a body, right? We'll set aside the intentional stuff. A Buddha was still born, and their story, because the Buddha was still born, despite the fact that he's awakening, he's still going to age, he's still going to grow sick, he's still going to die, right? There is no avoiding that particular type of karma, right? There's no cause and effect. And I think the implication with like the foot hurting, and I think if I remember correctly, and Ram, maybe you can correct me or someone else from the room, but if I remember correctly, like, didn't it have traces on like kicking someone or something, or kicking at something, like almost like he'd kicked something and now like his foot was hurting, right? As like kind of the karmic consequence that was exhausting itself. What is getting burned off? That might be a question for a deeper scholar than myself. I know at the time, there was lots of conflicting opinion at the time of the Buddha. There was conflicting opinions about the Jains lived at the same time. The Jains believe that karma is actually a substance that attaches itself to, for lack of a better word, a soul. And that it literally is a substance that gets burned off through inaction in their part, right? And I think in this case, there's despite the fact that the Buddha no longer created new karma, there's still leftovers and there's still residuals from past actions that would play out in his life. In the same way that Angulimala was getting beat with sticks, but his mind was still controlled. His mind was still still. That makes sense? It's not quite what you're asking.
That was a good answer.
Okay. Try. I'm looking at the clock and I saw the 3-minute mark when you finished your question. I'm like,
that was really heartfelt. And thank you for opening your story, your life story, and finding a connection in a way to convey that story, you know, to us. That was very special. It was very heartfelt, and I'm pretty impressed that you kept it together.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. That was really, it was very touching, very relatable, because we've all done things that maybe we got away with, you know, some of us get away with it, some of us don't get away with it, and some of us have to, you know, everything happens for a reason in life. And the mere fact that you were able to identify that with yourself and then come here today and convey that to all of us was very powerful and very heartfelt. So I thank you for this moment.
Thank you so much, man.
One more. Sorry, it's really quick. It's my first time to fit. I didn't know what to expect. Opening this door is really key. Maybe look at the room of all, you know, books found, the carpet. Really cute. It's the whole vibe around here. We feel like maybe this is how people connect when before phone time, people just gather around telling story, sharing. It's really cute. The vibe. About the story, what stood out to me is the part where, you know, Buddha comes into the forest it's such a long name.
Angulimala.
Angulimala. Chase asked, you will not stop. And the first question was, well, what do you mean? I guess that's the, you know, that makes sense. Yeah, I use the one that running, I'm not. But the second part, which really stood out to me, that he realized that you came to save me, you came to help me. I think that's really resonate with me, because probably so many times in my life where I think I didn't deserve to be saved. I think I could be better. Maybe that's the first step to realize that I can be better, that I deserve to be saved. And I, yes, giving credit to the Buddha, but so, you know, so much of that turning around was, you know, what's his name again?
Angulimala.
Was doing it themselves, you know, to sit through, to meditate, sit through into awakening. Yes, he had to do it himself. I think that's important. I think related to probably all of us, done things that we ashamed of, you know, are not wrong, get away with. we can turn it around. We can be saved. We deserve to be saved. Maybe it's us that recognize that first. So yeah, that really what stood out to me. Thank you. It's really helpful. Thank you.
And I know. Can I piggyback up what you said? Because like there is something about that moment that Buddha's in the forest and really Mala realizes he's there for his sake. And I just want to throw it, it doesn't have to be a Buddha. Like I remember sitting in Folsom State Prison after chow in the yard, and at 6:30 in the evening, all the volunteers, that's when they would let them in. They'd start streaming in on the yard. They'd distribute over to education or the chapel, Greystone Chapel, where Johnny Cash sang that song about. They all start going to their separate places. It might be the Buddhist group over here and the AA meeting over there and the NA meeting over there, the Don Miguel Ruiz Four Agreements group over there and the yoga group over there. These are all just free people in their free time coming in. And all of us saw them stream in and said, they're here for my sake. Those people came in for my sake, for no reason other than to be here for my sake. And that's just powerful, part of my French. You know, it is. Like when you realize someone is here and giving you that attention and it's for your sake and your sake alone, there's no ulterior motives. They're all Buddhists, right?